The current Los Angeles Lakers are awful. Anyone who witnessed their 48-point loss to the Clippers on Thursday night knows that. But during the 1980s, the Lakers won 5 NBA titles, and they brought to L.A. the phenomenon that came to be known as Showtime. Magic Johnson, the Fabulous Forum, Pat Riley filing for a copyright on the phrase three-peat. It just didn't get any glitzier than that. Or at least that's the way Jeff Perlman sees it in his new book titled, not surprisingly, Showtime. Jeff, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right, here's one detail that may surprise your readers. Jerry West, celebrated as a great builder of Lakers teams, but the former Lakers star player turned team executive, quote, wasn't fully convinced that a 6'9" point guard would function in the fast-paced NBA. And that 6'9" point guard would be...
some guy named Magic Johnson.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I know. How could West not have, I mean.
Well, you know what? To be totally honest with you, I don't think he was alone in that assessment. I mean, there'd never been a 6'9 point guard. And I think the thinking was, at the time, he had a lot of smaller point guards, Norm Nixon and Tiny Archibald and a lot of guys like that. They were small, quick, sort of gnat-like guys. And I think there was a real debate whether Magic Johnson at 6'9 would even be able to cross midcourt, you know, dribbling the ball that high. Mm. I mean, the benefits, obviously, is you can see over defense, but I think a lot of people were concerned. And at the time, the University of Arkansas had a superstar named Sidney Moncrief, who actually went on to a great NBA career. And there was a lot of debate, not just with the Lakers, but with a lot of people, whether the number one pick would be Magic Johnson or Sidney Moncrief.
You characterized Lakers center and the NBA's all-time leading scorer, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, as rude, boorish, cruel, selfish. At one point you write, and I'm quoting now, he possessed the emotional IQ of a toddler. Now, I've interviewed Kareem in his retirement more than once for Only a Game, and he's always been reasonably pleasant. Did you have a grudge to settle with him?
No, I grew up a huge Kareem Abdul-Jabbar fan. I'm still a huge Kareem Abdul-Jabbar fan. When you write these books, you know, I interviewed, I don't know, whatever, 290 people for the book. It's about the interpretations of other people and how they felt. And there's a story in the book that I thought was very telling because it happened all the time. Kareem is in Utah, and it's one of his last seasons. It might be his last season in the NBA. And he's crossing the street, and this car stops, and this man jumps out, right? And he's like probably one of 7 African-Americans in Salt Lake City. And he jumps out of the car, and he says, "Oh, my God, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you are my favorite player of all time. I'm coming home from the hospital with my son. This is the greatest day ever. My son has been born, and I'm meeting Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Would you do me the favor, please, of signing an autograph for me? This would just mean the most." And Kareem goes, "No, I'm not going to do that." The guy slams the door, rolls down his window, and screams out some vulgarity. And Kareem, he goes to the guy he's walking with, "Well, I'm quite happy I didn't sign for that particular gentleman." I mean, he'll probably tell you now, he didn't sign autographs. He blew off kids. He was terrible to fans. He was okay to teammates. He just was a very standoffish guy. Now, the one thing I'll say, Bill, that's important is everybody has a reason for who they are and what you become. He was a museum piece from the time he was a kid. He was always the tall kid, the athletic freak. So I think over time, he became very weary and very guarded. So I'm not saying he doesn't have reason for it. I'm saying he did not treat people particularly well.
Jerry Buss owned the Lakers during the Showtime era, and he presided over the Fabulous Forum. And I'm not talking about the place where they played basketball. It was the place where they played other things after the game, too, right?
Well, the Forum Club was the place in the Forum, and it was basically a bar restaurant. And it was a place anyone and everyone wanted to get to. Jerry Buss would preside over this long dinner table, and he'd have, you know, maybe a blonde to his right and a brunette to his left, and they were both in their early 20s. And you'd see whoever, John Travolta or, you know, Harry Belafonte, I don't know, a million different celebrities. And after the game, all the players would rush to the Forum Club, and it was the hot spot. A lot of people said it was a huge home court advantage for the Lakers, because if you're playing for the Detroit Pistons, all you wanted to do after the game was go to the Forum Club. So you were fourth quarter, maybe you're down by 9, and you're thinking who you're going to meet at the Forum Club and whether you need to wear cologne or what you're going to. So it was like this huge home court advance because it was the only place like it. They certainly didn't have it at the Boston Garden or Madison Square Garden. It was very unique. To be honest with you, I'm very sad that I never had a chance to hang out at the Forum Club, but there would have been no sports writers allowed anyway, so.
Despite the enormous presence of the stars, Johnson, Kareem, James Worthy, A.C. Green, and so on, some of the best stories in your book involve players of whom lots of casual fans won't even have heard. Give us a good Billy Thompson story.
First of all, let me just say, Bill, the thing is, people miss this. The key to writing these books isn't the Magic Johnsons. Because Magic Johnson has written a gazillion books. Kareem has written two or three books. I love, give me an hour in a diner with Wes Matthews. The Cheesecake Factory with Billy Thompson was just awesome and great. And Billy Thompson was a star at Louisville. You know, he has like a Karl Malone-esque body where he can just, you know, physically play. But he's a complete and total space cadet. My favorite story, Kurt Rambis told it to me, and it's great, is one day they're in a huddle, and Pat Riley's talking over. Billy Thompson lets loose with this really fierce sneeze, and his front teeth come flying out of his mouth and go into the floor. But there are so many guys like that on the fringes of Showtime who I'd love to get into.
As the end of the 80s approached, there were indications that Showtime was coming to a close, and one of the more apparent was a change in Pat Riley's sense of how important he was to the whole extravaganza. You refer to the cult of Pat Riley and how the coach became a flesh-eating hoops zombie, which is pretty graphic. Give us an example or two of that.
Well, he was a great coach, like a great coach, and, you know, there's no denying what he did and his accomplishments and decency overall. Toward the end, he clearly, and I couldn't find a player who would disagree with this, got caught up in himself and got caught up in the tow of Pat Riley. His last season, he won the NBA Coach of the Year. It's sort of ironic. It was his final season, and he won the NBA Coach of the Year. And John Black was the media relations guy for the Lakers at the time, and he had a really tough relationship with Pat Riley that year. He said Pat Riley was just impossible to deal with. But it's his job, it's John's job, to go out and tell Pat Riley that he won the Coach of the Year. And they're playing Phoenix in the playoffs, and Pat Riley's tanning by the pool. And John Black, I know it's sort of an image, you know, you can picture it. And John Black walks out to the pool, and he says, "Pat, I got some news for you. You were named Coach of the Year, so when do you want to do the press conference?" And Riley doesn't answer. And John says, "No, Pat, I don't know if you heard me, but you won the Coach of the Year." And he goes, you know, in more graphic language, he goes, "Screw it, I'm not doing it." And what do you mean you're not doing it? Screw them, I'm not doing it. He did do it eventually, but he was just like, he became unbearable. And I think it happens with coaches. You know, after a while, you push, it's going to wear out. But again, his track record is undeniable.
Has every successful NBA team since the Showtime era, the Heat these days, for example, become Showtime, or was what the Lakers had during the 80s unique?
Oh, I think it was really unique. Like really, and I'm not just saying that because I wrote a book. First of all, they were really like a family. I literally was talking a few minutes ago to Wanda Cooper, Michael Cooper's ex-wife. And she was saying, like, she looks back at that time so gloriously because it was just a big family. And everyone felt like they were in it together. And all the players hung out together. And if one was going to a movie, 10 guys were going to a movie. And nowadays, I don't think anyone would argue this, sports has become much more corporate, much more image conscious. You can't go as many places because some boob with a phone is going to take a picture and put it on TMZ. And So I don't think it's possible to have what they had back then. Maybe on the court, but definitely not off the court.
Jeff Perlman is the author of Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the LA Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s. Jeff, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. That was great.
To read an excerpt of Jeff Perlman's Showtime, please visit onlyagame.org and think of our website as a kind of public radio fabulous forum. It's Showtime. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years, offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.
Fans of the hapless New York Knicks are mad as heck, and they're not going to take it anymore, or at least some of them aren't. A group calling themselves Knicks Fans for Life will stage a rally on March 19th outside Madison Square Garden, where the Knicks will play the Pacers that night. A statement released by the group cites the failure of Knicks owner James Dolan, quote, to allow knowledgeable basketball people the autonomy / power to make basketball-related decisions. One cautious observer of the shambles the sub-400 Knicks have become worries that picket lines and uprisings reflect poorly on the franchise. But he concedes, so does the season.